There are two kind of traditional sermon beginnings that I try to stay away from. One is, on my way here, as I was parked at a stoplight, it occurred to me that, because normally when I'm driving, the only thing that occurs to me is survival. The other is the I Had a Dream sermon. But today is one of those dream sermons because on Saturday morning, Friday night, I had a dream that I found disturbing, and yet on the topic of what I wanted to talk about today. My dream was that I had showed up to do a wedding, which happens to me. It's an occupational hazard. I show up and weddings happen. It's kind of like Mrs. Fletcher in Murders. And I showed up and someone said, no, you misunderstand the situation. You're here to do a funeral. And I said, well, I better change my material. And before the cynics out there say, what's the difference between a wedding and a funeral? And I know some of you are already there. It's an important distinction. So I prepared myself to do the funeral, to do the memorial service, to talk about this person's life and what that life meant to me and to the people present. But there was noise coming from outside because indeed there was a wedding waiting to take place. And I went outside and I said, there's a funeral in here. Can't you keep your voices down a little bit? Because there's sorrow and there's mourning. And the people said, no, but we're happy. We're celebrating. We're about to get married and embark on our lives together, and this is a celebration of our love. And at that point, I woke up, and I thought about it for a while, and it struck me, first of all, after about 2.5 minutes of contemplation, it struck me why I had had that dream, and that is because next week I am going up to conduct a wedding ceremony for the son of a very dear friend of mine whose memorial service I can also anticipate because he is very ill and does not have a good long-term outlook. And that's where it came from. But the truth is deeper than what merely struck me in the middle of Friday night, Saturday morning. And that is, we are always dealing in situations of seriousness, of mourning, of letting go, of pain, of, yes, of suffering. And there is also joy in the depth of our sorrows in the next room. There's laughter that intrudes, sometimes obnoxiously, it seems to us, on our grief and breaks our concentration. But that is the nature of the cycle of life and the world that we live in. When we read the newspapers, when we think about talking to our congresspeople, when we listen to the talking, screaming, yelling heads on television, on radio, we know about the pain in the world. We know about what doesn't work, the planes that crashed, the tens and thousands of people who died in an earthquake yesterday in Pakistan, Afghanistan, Kashmir. We know that that pain is awful and terrible. We open up our newspapers and we see in every week the list of soldiers who are killed. We can imagine the list of civilians who are killed all over the world. The pain is palpable and inexplicable, inexpressible to the people who are going through it. And at the very same time that I am aware of all of this pain, that I have watched the news all day Saturday, and I turn on and now I start to watch the football games, and I am yelling and cheering, I won't tell you for or against whom, for reasons that will come up later in the sermon, Mitzi. But I'm also passionate and joyous and distraught about absolutely trivial stuff. That's the nature of life. I remember once, many years ago, when I was asked to do a comedy routine for the General Assembly. And I did a comedy routine, and it included jokes about death. Because what are the three big topics of humor? Sex, death, and toilets. And I concentrated on death because the other two I didn't think were appropriate for religion. So I was taken aside and chastised afterwards by a former president of the UUA saying, how can you joke about death when people out there, of the 1,500 people, you know death had touched so many of them during the course of the last year? Well, yes. We live in this extraordinarily complex and fragile miracle. When we move from room to room, from a wedding to a funeral, from a banquet to seeing starvation, from issues of deep and fundamental concern to just ultimate trivia, and we are human and we respond to all of it, and it is, if we are paying any attention at all, a disorienting experience. And one of the things that religion at its best can do is to help us understand our role and our relationship in all of these different rooms that we go into, and all of to try to understand how it is that we should behave when we go from a house of mourning to a house of joy to just something that is silly and trivial and fun. Because it's very hard. One of the other dreams that I have frequently had, and I honestly have had this one frequently, is a version of what Charles Durang wrote in his play, The Actor's Nightmare, where the actor is forced out, shows up at the theater, and just a member of the audience shows up at the theater, and the director says, thank God you're here, you're the great actor, and you have to go on tonight. He says, I'm not an actor, and I don't know the play. And he's pushed out on the stage anyway. And the lines appear to be from Private Lives from Noel Coward. And he's trying to figure out what the play is. Is it a comedy? Is it a tragedy? Is it a drama? What's going on? And just by the time he figures out what it is, all of a sudden there's a shift change, and it's Endgame by Samuel Beckett. And he's, again, totally disoriented. And then it shifts again, and it's Man for All Seasons, and he ends up losing his head. This play strikes me as being very true about how we lead our lives. Religion tries to give us a sense of context, to know who we are and what is permanent in us, as opposed to transitional in terms of mood, as we move from place to place in the various stations of life. Religion at its best gives us some of the tools, some of the rituals to make us know that we are not alone, that our pains are not unique, that our ways of coping have so much in common. When we sang that first hymn from Rumi, and it's from a Muslim tradition, at the days of awe, we can look at what religions have in common. And almost all religions that I know of try to give us times and places and ways to learn about ourselves, to learn who we are, so that we don't have to be completely different, dissociated characters when we walk from room to room, from mood to mood. In the Jewish calendar, Rosh Hashanah is the new year, Yom Kippur, the Day of Atonement. There are 10 days called the Days of Awe in between, where people are asked to look at themselves and their lives and make real resolutions. Not just the I'll lose 10 pounds resolution, but look inside at what we are doing with our lives, at what our values truly are, at who we truly are at the deepest level, and to turn away from those things that do not reflect the best of our sense of selves, and return to who we are. 10 days of awe. In the Muslim world, the Ashura, which means 10, are 10 days also of contemplation. 10 days of self-examination, quite apart from the 40 days of Ramadan. Christianity, you have Lent. How long is Lent? 40 days. What an incredible coincidence. 40 days of Ramadan, 40 days of Lent, 40 days and nights of the Noahic flood, 40 years wandering in the desert, 40 nights and days for Moses on Sinai, 40 days of meditation for Jesus in the desert. Do you discern a pattern? Our religions are trying to tell us at our best that everyone, from the lowest level to Moses to Jesus, needs to take time out to look inside. That's such a simple little message, isn't it? But to look inside in a profound way. Not the 10 pounds. Lose the 10 pounds, fine. But not the 10-pound way. The who am I? What is it that I want to turn away from and turn towards? Last year I shared with you that the Hebrew word for repent is to turn, tshuva, to turn back towards yourself, towards your own best values. The Greek word is metanoia, which means literally to change mind, but our metaphor would be to change heart. To have the opportunity in every religion, Jewish, Christian, Muslim, certainly the contemplative Eastern religions of Hinduism and Buddhism, to take that time to go inside and to voyage deeply. The Nigun that we began with, which I didn't know we were going to begin with, which is a wordless song. What is a wordless song in the Eastern tradition? It's a mantra. These are melodies to keep our brains busy so that we can do some of the internal work that wordy people need to do. There's an old Hasidic story that a bunch of really bright people from this little temple were sitting around, and they heard the janitor reciting the alphabet in Hebrew. While the learned people were talking high concepts and what does this law mean and what are the best prayers, here was the janitor just doing Aleph, Bet, Vet, Gimel, Dalef, Hey, Vav, Zion, reciting the alphabet. And the disciples of this Rebbe said, "What is this fool doing?" And the Rebbe said to his disciples, "You're the fools. He's the most religious person in the room, because he's trusting God to put it into order." That the sounds, the songs, the alphabet are not about the words. They're about the way that we can let go and honestly open ourselves up to insights about ourselves and our lives and how we're leading our lives. One of, I think, the great problems in much of Western religion, and let's make that, by Western religion I mean west of the Mississippi, religion, is that we tend to have very high production values. We don't trust people to contemplate, to meditate, to do a spiritual journey within the framework of a religious service, and I mean that from Unitarian to Baptist to Presbyterian to three branches of Judaism. We want to be interesting all of the time. And I think that there are times when it is important to zone out. I prefer you didn't do it during at least the beginning of the sermon. But if some place in the sermon takes you someplace inside and you miss the rest, that's fine. Because part of what we're doing in a special time on Sundays, or in Judaism on Saturdays, and Islam on Fridays, is to be in a place where we do our mantras, where we look at mandalas, where we can take journeys that are important. Because the great temptation, the great rule of inertia, is that we continue to go in the direction that we start out going. And to say, this is wrong for me, or this isn't working, or this is wrong for the world, or maybe I should, I hate to use a Dr. Phil line, but to ask ourselves, well, so how's it working for you? For us to ask this from time to time is a very valuable and, I think, universal religious impulse. Sure, last week when I talked about religion and why religion matters, I didn't do all of the bad things about religion. No. Yes, there have been religious wars and people use it for us and them. Yes, people get caught up in the minutiae of religious rules and miss the heart, the true fundamental of religion. But it's true of everything else. Human beings can do this academically. One or two of you have experienced academic warfare. We do it in business. We do it in sports. Here's the Mitzi part. You walk in here today in a Yankee t-shirt and see how long you last. We might tolerate a Trinitarian here. You're an atheist. You're okay with us. You are wrestling with issues of politics of the left and right. We'll work really hard at being tolerant of you, but there are some things, you know, that are just too important. And rooting for the Angels as opposed to against the Angels could possibly be one of those things for some of us. I remember that candle 2 years ago. But not a candle. But not a candle. Our default position is us and them. And it takes an act of will to step back from the threshold of righteousness, of anger, of superiority, and say, okay, you're different. I don't have to hate you because you're different. I can be a really good me, and you can be a really good you, and we can be different. Because we need to look at those things that are the permanent character issues that truly determines who we are as we move from pain to joy to grief to loss to hope, hate, love, and all of the emotions that we feel. I have felt caught up in the actor's nightmare from time to time. The actor's nightmare for me does not involve Man for All Seasons, Private Lives, and Endgame. It involves Death of a Salesman, where I show up at the theater and somebody says, you're on. And I say, but I don't know the part. When I was younger, it was Biff. It's now Willie. I don't know the part. And the director says, do you know the character? I said, yeah, I know the character. And the director says, well, if you know the character, you will respond correctly to the situation. Well, my first thought is panic, of course. But the second thought is, yeah, that should work. Maybe not 100% of the time, but that should work. And so what these seasons are for, from Ramadan, Ashura, Days of Awe, Lent, what these seasons are for is for us to find those times and places and spaces where we can go inside so that we can know the character, not of Biff Lohman or Willie Lohman or Linda, but the character that we each carry with us. So that as we move through the cycles and circles of life with each other, we respond more and more with character and in character. Rituals are reminders, not replacements. I can blow the shofar until I'm red in the face. Blowing it at all is until I'm red in the face. And unless it is a wake-up call for me to look inside, it's only hot air. Every ritual is a reminder of how to be, not a replacement for being decent, in character, and practicing our religion, not as our beliefs, but as values translated by character from person to person to the world. Every day is a new day. Every year, a new year. Every moment, we have an opportunity of refocusing ourselves on the targets that we have chosen for ourselves. Every moment is a chance to turn and return to our own best selves.